Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
You know, there's one story where William Adams takes them to visit the magnificent great copper Buddha at Kamakura. And the first thing they do is they etch their names into the copper, you know, scratching. It's a fantastically English story. There they go. Graffiti the thing, you know.
Hello. On the 19th of April, 1600, after nearly 2 years at sea, William Adams, one of only 9 surviving crew members, made land at modern-day Osuki on the east coast of Japan. He was starving, scurvy-ridden, and close to death. But so began an extraordinary story, as Adams rose up the ranks to become a revered figure in Japan even today. So much so that a new Disney TV series, Shogun, has been making waves. And so with that in mind, I got Giles Milton back to give us the backstory, which goes well with my chat with Frederick Crins from a few weeks ago. Giles is the author of Samurai William, an entertaining history of the first Englishman to visit the land of the rising sun. Please do share with friends and family and the like-minded. Plenty more great history to come. And if you can give me a good review, I'd be hugely grateful. But until then, let's talk William Adams and Shogun with Giles Milton. Well, Giles, welcome back. Great to have you on. Thanks for joining.
Thanks for having me back on.
And actually, for listeners, we'll be going to be speaking to Giles again in a couple of weeks because he has a new book out. But before that, we are talking William Adams. And Giles wrote a book about William Adams. Now, you might be thinking, who's William Adams? William Adams, well, he's not Shogun, but he is the main character in the very successful Apple show, Shogun. And Giles is the author of Samurai William, and that is based on the life of William Adams, the first Englishman to travel to Japan, and it's an extraordinary story. Giles, why did you want to write about William Adams?
Well, because, I mean, Shogun, it's a fabulous show for a start, and I'm sure lots of people are enjoying it. But, of course, it's based on a novel by James Clavell, which was all about this character called John Blackthorne, who goes off to Japan and has all sorts of adventures there at the court of the Shogun. But what few people realise is that John Blackthorne, James Clavell, based his main character on a true, an actual, you know, living flesh and blood Jacobean mariner who was called William Adams, who did indeed sail to Japan and had the most extraordinary adventures and life out there. And when I began to look into his life, I just thought, my God, the true story. I mean, the novel's great, but the true story is even better, you know?
Yeah, because I was reading about him, and he has quite an interesting life before he gets to Japan. He's a veteran of the Spanish Armada, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, the thing about William Adams is he's a highly skilled pilot, as they were known. So he knew how to sail ships in particularly difficult circumstances. So he was much sought after for battles or taking part in delicate trading missions to dangerous places. And so what happens is that in 1598, the Dutch are going to launch a fleet to sail to the Spice Islands. And the fact that he's English doesn't really bother the Dutch. The fact that he's a really good pilot is a real bonus for them. So they hire him. And this fleet sets of five ships set sail across the Atlantic. They're going to take an extraordinary journey down the North Atlantic, South Atlantic, through the Magellan Straits, and then across the Pacific. Now, of course, what happens is what always happens on these things. It goes disastrously wrong. They get scurvy, they get dysentery, half of them die, they're starving, they've got no water, you know, they run out of supplies. And by the time the fleet gets into the Pacific, there's a massive storm, all five ships are scattered, and there's one ship, the Liefde, which means the love, is on its own and sort of drifts across the Pacific for months with these dying men on board. And finally, they sight land and come into the shore and realize that they've come to the island of Japan. And this is where, I mean, there's already quite a prelude to the adventure, but this is where the big adventure really starts.
Okay, they're a scurvy-ridden crew, those that have survived. There were originally five ships, weren't there, in the expedition? Yeah.
We're talking hundreds of mariners on board these ships. And by the time the Liefde gets to Japan, there's like, you know, a dozen men left alive. So the death toll has been quite extraordinary. I mean, it was said that they were so hungry that they were gnawing on the leather straps that were wrapped around the ropes of the shipping. You know, they were in a very, very bad way. And actually, probably of them all, William Adams was had the strongest constitution and was really one of the only ones that could actually walk ashore when they finally washed up in Japan.
And did you look into this sort of, because I'm interested in scurvy, the symptoms of scurvy?
It's horrible. It's a horrible disease. I mean, you know, one of the symptoms is all your teeth fall out, your skin goes blotchy. But actually, here's a really interesting fact that most people think Captain Cook was the one that discovered that if you suck on lemons and oranges and stuff, it actually cures scurvy. But actually, one of the early captains of the East India Company, Sir James Lancaster, way, way before Captain Cook, actually discovered this and kept his men healthy on these vastly long journeys across to the East Indies. And it was forgotten about for 100 years or more. And so actually, these Jacobean mariners, you know, some of them knew of this, but it just got lost, you know.
I remember when I was in university in the 90s, there was a rumour, and it might be urban legend, that a student had got scurvy because he had worked out a way to save money was just to eat porridge oats every single meal. And the result was the first case of scurvy in the country for sort of 100 years.
That's fantastic. I like that.
So when he arrives in Japan, and this is captured quite well in the show, actually, the Portuguese have got Japan sort of sewed up, really. They've persuaded the Japanese that the Portuguese are the only Europeans who exist, and they have nice, generous, lucrative trade deals in place with the Japanese. And Adams throws a spanner in the works of all that, doesn't he?
He does, and it's worth recalling, really, that the Spanish and the Portuguese really hate the Dutch and the English, you know. And so when this Dutch ship washes up with an Englishman on board, this is the worst possible news for the Spanish and Portuguese, and particularly for the Jesuits who have really installed themselves in Japan, you know, to see this filthy Protestant turning up on their shores, you know, they want him dead. And so actually, Adams's first hurdle, or his first enemy, is certainly not the Japanese themselves. It's the Portuguese and Spanish. Of course, he's totally reliant on them to interpret. So when he's hauled up before the mightiest warlord in Japan, which is Tokugawa Ieyasu, and he's using these Jesuits to translate for him, they're doing everything they can possibly do to say, this guy's a pirate, you know, you should execute him immediately. And the fact that they're so adamant that he should be executed sort of arouses Ieyasu's, he's just intrigued, really. And he thinks, well, if they hate him that much, there must be something quite special about this guy. And he decides that he actually wants to find out more about him. And so thus begins the very beginnings of this extraordinary relationship that's going to develop between William Adams and the most powerful warlord in Japan.
And Japan at the time, it feels as though, certainly from the show, quite a closed society. They weren't particularly keen on mixing with other foreigners, were they?
No, and this is one of the wonderful things when I was writing the book is so often when you're talking about these early stories of exploration, you only ever have one side of the story. So you only get the story told by the English or the Dutch who kept diaries and whatever on board their ship. The wonderful thing about writing about Japan is you have a kind of wealth of literature of how the Japanese viewed the arrival of these people. And I can tell you, they were not impressed by these stinking, starving, scurvy-ridden, dysentery sort of, ill, sickly men washing up at their shores who had absolutely no concept of, the hierarchy of Japanese society and courtly etiquette and everything. They blundered their way, making mistakes all the way through. So it was absolutely fantastic to have this window onto our culture from as seen by the Japanese. So yeah, they weren't impressed, but William Adams had one thing, major thing in his favor. First of all, he arrived in Japan at a time of great turmoil, political turmoil. This was a period of feudal warlords who were battling against each other. And this was about to reach a climax where two of the greatest warlords were about to do battle at what became known as the Battle of Sekigahara, which was a monumental battle. I mean, it was said that there were 80,000 troops each opposing army, which were going to do battle. Now, Ieyasu, getting talking to William Adams and seeing his ship, the Liefde, he realizes that this ship is armed with some extremely powerful Dutch cannon. And what he does is he brings them ashore. He has them brought ashore. He has his men trained how to use them, and he wheels them over to the Battle of Sekigahara. Now, how effective these were on the day, we just don't know. But it seems likely that these had a devastating effect on the enemy forces. And certainly by the end of the day, Ieyasu is not only victor of the battle, but this has made him the ultimate sort of warlord of the whole of Japan, at which point he becomes the ruling shogun. He's the top guy, and William Adams is his favorite bloke.
And that number of 80,000 on each side, I mean, that's an unprecedented number by European standards, isn't it?
Absolutely. And the death toll was enormous. You've got these samurai wielding their vast scimitars, slashing each other to pieces. I mean, there's very, very colourful accounts of the battle itself. But the important thing, I think, from William Adams's point of view is that this showed to the Shogun that this guy was useful to him, that, what other skills could he bring? And it turned out over the months and years that followed that actually William Adams had a great deal to offer Ieyasu. So an important turning point here.
Yes, yeah, so how advanced were, I mean, his main skill was as a pilot, Adams. And so how skilled were the Japanese at shipbuilding and that kind of, at the advent of sail and all that kind of stuff? How were they?
Well, this is one of really the skills that Adams brings to Japan, actually. So of course the Japanese haven't got their ships, they've got the Japanese fleet and everything. But Ieyasu is particularly interested in the Liefde, in how it's built, the construction of the vessel, the fact it sailed, not only across the Pacific, but it's navigated the extremely treacherous Magellan Straits, and made it to Japan. And so he asks William Adams to build a replica of the Liefde, which is one of several ships that Adams is going to build. And Ieyasu is really, really impressed by the end result. It's exactly what he wanted. And this is where he begins to shower William Adams with rewards. So first of all, he's given an allowance. Then he's given a townhouse in Edo, which became Tokyo. And then he's given a vast country estate with a whole virtual army of serfs that work for him. And ultimately, as he gets showered with reward after reward after reward, he is made what's called a hatamoto or a bannerman, which effectively raises him to the rank of samurai in Japan. So, I mean, but William Adams, he's a humble mariner, comes from Limehouse in London, has, no background, absolutely no money, comes from a very impoverished sort of stock, suddenly finds himself in Japan at the highest levels of, the courtly hierarchy, with a large landed estate and everyone sort of bowing and ta bowing to him. It's a remarkable transformation in his life.
Well, the Shogun does not allow him to return to England, I don't think. He's sort of confined to Japan for many, many years. But why would he want to go back?
Well,
apart from the wife and two kids, I should mention.
He left a wife and family back in Limehouse, who are probably wondering where on earth he's got to, you know, by this point. Actually, quite a few years go by, and you're right, that IESO thinks this guy is just too useful to me for me to let him ever leave Japan. So he basically says, you're never leaving, but here's your riches and your rewards. And at this point, William Adams thinks, well, look, I'm never going to see Mary again back in Limehouse. I might as well get married again. So he takes a second wife, who's called Oyuki, and has two children with her, who are called Joseph and Susanna. And he essentially builds a new life in Japan. But he is homesick and he's desperate to see Englishmen again. The few crew members who are still alive when they washed up in Japan, most of them have dropped dead by now. So he's on his own. And he wants to see Englishmen again. And then in 1611, he hears some news, some dramatic news, is that the East India Company has established a trading post in Java, which is quite a long way from Japan, but not as far as England. And so he writes a letter, which he hopes a Dutch ship will take to Java for him. And rather forlornly, it's addressed to my unknown friends and countrymen. And he begs them to come and do trade with Japan. He says there's all sorts of riches waiting. And so this is the first moment where the possibility of Anglo-Japanese trade is first mooted. And it will be followed shortly afterwards by a ship that arrives from England.
And so these five ships that had left 11 years before in 1600, I think it was, or maybe it's a bit before
1598
that.
They left, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yes, right. Okay. And were they sort of written off? Okay, well, they must have just sunk in this journey and no one was really missing him apart from Mary and the children?
Well, the ships were Dutch, of course, and yeah, I think one or two of them limped home, one of them sank, and that they met with various sort of terrible fates. But, you know, this was a period where both the Dutch East India Company and the English East India Company, both newly formed, were desperately searching for new markets. They'd already gone out to the Spice Islands. As I said, they established both bases, both of them, in Java and on the various islands of what is now Indonesia. But now they receive this letter from William Adams, which eventually finds its way back to London. And the East India Company thinks, there might be some riches here. Maybe the Japanese, they think Japan's quite far north. So surely they're going to want woolen cloth and stuff that we produce in England. So they send out a ship called the Clove. And it's it's captained by this fantastic commander called Captain John Saris, who's incredibly flamboyant and eccentric, who never leaves home without his extensive collection of pornography and erotica, which he has these pictures of naked women decking the cabin of his ship. It's a fantastic story. And anyway, they finally arrive in Japan in the summer of 1613. And thus begins this great new chapter in the story where William Adams now gets to meet his unknown friends and countrymen. And of course, it doesn't all go that well.
No, him and Saris, they just don't get on, do they?
The problem is that these sort of stinking Jacobean sea dogs arrive in Japan and they find this rather prim William Adams dressed in gorgeous silks, you know, and speaking fluent Japanese by this point. And one of them actually says, I've got a little quote here, it's quite funny, because he says, of William Adams, he said, he gave so admirable and affectionated commendations of the country, as it is generally thought amongst us, that he's a naturalized Japaner. And so what they're basically saying is he's gone native, you know, and Adams has gone native, and he's not particularly keen to help this band of men who, frankly, all they want to do after two and a half years at sea is get pissed and sleep with the local women, you know. So it becomes, he finds himself having to control this uncontrollable rabble who don't want to do trade. They want to drink heavily.
It's quite interesting how, you know, he obviously, as you say, he's sort of gone native. And when he first arrived, perhaps he would have got on with Saris and co. Now, as you say, he's become this sort of refined Japanese aristocrat.
He has, and he also understands very clearly that if you want to get on in Japan, you have to abide by the rules of Japanese etiquette, which means when you go and meet Aiyasu, you have to sort of bow and scrape and touch your forelock on the floor and everything. Now, Captain John Cyrus, he just refuses to do that. And so none of them will conform to this incredibly important courtly etiquette that's prevalent in Japanese society. So that's one problem. But I think it's just that the fact is that they didn't have much interest in trade. They just wanted to have some fun after all this time at sea. And what I think the most remarkable thing for me when I was researching the book was that virtually every single letter that these men, there were, I'm just trying to remember how many of them were left there. There's about a dozen of them were left in Japan. And all their letters and diaries have actually miraculously survived. And they don't hold back when they describe their life in Japan. They tell exactly what they're getting up to, the drunken brawls they're in, the women they manage to sleep with, everything goes into their letters and diaries. And because when these were sent back to England, the East India Company, they had these fastidious clerks who kept records of everything. Every single piece of correspondence was copied, diligently copied down and kept in the archives. So when I came to write this book, I found that the story of their daily life was remarkable and extraordinary. When Captain John Cyrus, who's brought the ship to Japan, he's going to leave behind a big boss who's going to be the sort of trading manager, if you like. And he's this chap called Richard Cox. Now, Richard Cox, he's sort of interested in trade, but he soon develops a passion for goldfish. And he sees that the Japanese sort of courtly lords, they love to have, you know, goldfish ponds and everything, and constantly swapping their prize goldfish. And he gets into this and he spends all his spare cash on prize goldfish. There's wonderful, wonderful stories about this. And he's also obsessed with growing his own vegetables. And so his vegetable patch becomes his, you know, his little empire in Japan. And it's wonderful because it's so... You can really relate to it on a human level, how these people are in this country on the other side of the world, knowing that if they're ever going to get back to England, it's going to be another 2.5 year voyage home again, you know. So they really build their lives there and they write about their lives there. And it's a window onto another world.
Did you go out to Japan?
I did, because obviously I wanted to find out what Japanese records were there. My Japanese is not as fluent as William Adams is, so I had the help of a researcher when I was there. But what surprised me is that everyone in Japan has heard of William Adams. Like, no one in England has heard of him, but everyone in Japan has. And I think it's the sort of thing, when you're at primary school, it's like in England, you learn about sort of Francis Drake or something like that. They all learn about William Adams, except they don't know his name. If you said William Adams, they'll draw a blank. They won't know who you're talking about. They all know him as Mayura Anjin, which is effectively in Japanese, is Mr. Pilot. He's known as Mr. Pilot. And they all know the stories about him. They know about his grave in Japan. They're all taught about it because it's sort of a wonderful story.
Ah, oh, fascinating. I mean, because the Japanese culture is, I've never been, I'd absolutely love to go, but I had assumed that the culture, particularly in the early 17th century, would be reluctant to open itself up to a foreigner. And yet that's exactly what they did. It seems like it's this sort of closed country, but I guess as long as he had adapted, they were quite happy to have him in.
Well, yes, but you've got to remember one important thing, that this really happened. This window where Europeans sort of poured into the country to do trade was under the rule of Aiyasu, who was very open-minded, fascinated by the outside world and wanted to open up Japan. So as long as he was on the throne, both the Dutch and the English, and indeed the Spanish and Portuguese, were able to continue trading in the country. But as soon as he died in 1616, it was an absolute disaster for all the Westerners in Japan. The Jesuits had been converting vast numbers of people to Christianity. And this posed a huge threat to Japanese society, because in Japanese society, you swore absolute allegiance to the shogun or to your feudal warlord, you know. And the Jesuits taught that there is no lord higher than the Lord God, you know. And this was an ultimate challenge to Japanese authority. And the successor to Aiyasu thinks, well, I've just had enough of this. And he begins an extraordinary period of persecution, of executions, of the first of all of the Jesuits. He particularly targets the Spanish and Portuguese, but later he'll move on to the Dutch and English as well. And when I say persecutions and executions, these are grim. You know, they don't just burn people at the stake like we did lamely in, you know, Jacobean London. they devised this way where they tied the person to a stake, but they lit the fire all around the person, but about sort of 5 meters away. So the person was slowly sort of roasted to death. A particularly grim way to die. And so, I mean, there are absolutely horrific tales of the tortures that took place in this period after Ieyasu's death. And it was clear, really, that the writing was on the wall for the Europeans, and it was only a matter of time before they'd be expelled. And of course, then Japan was shut down. And for the next, you know, sort of 150, 200 years, until it was forced open by the Americans, Japan would be a completely closed country.
I had no idea about that. So what happens to Adams then in this, during this time of persecution of Westerners?
So, well, Adams, he falls sick. And as the persecution is just beginning, he falls sick and he dies. And so probably he dies at the right
sensible move
time, if you like. We have his last will and testament, which still exists, where rather touchingly, he leaves half his estate to his children in Japan, and he leaves the other half to his daughter in London. And he actually writes a note in his will. He said, "I'm not going to leave it to Mary, my wife in Limehouse, because she might marry again and then her husband might get my money. And I don't want that happening. You know, I want it to go to my daughter." So he writes this will. He dies and he's buried. And in the period of persecution, where even the Christian cemeteries, which were quite numerous in Japan by this period, they were all ransacked, they were pillaged and everything. And the local Japanese, who were very had a great affection for William Adams, they actually exhumed his bones. This was some years after he died, and they kept them safe, and they were later reinterred. And it's a fascinating story because his tomb still exists, and it was unclear whether they were actually his bones or not, you know. And they were re-exhumed a few years ago, and a whole series of forensic tests were done on them and DNA and everything. And it is almost, I mean, 99% certain that they are indeed the bones of William Adams. It was, you know, everything was right about them, including the age at which he died and et cetera, et cetera. So absolutely fascinating little postscript to the story, you know, of what happened to him.
Yeah, wonderful story. I watched a documentary about Japan where there was a small community of Dutch traders. Was there one community that was permitted in Japan, but almost isolated and not allowed to leave a sort of compound?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. In fact, even during the heyday of the trading, when the English and Dutch were there really trying to make a go of it, they were confined to a little island quite near Nagasaki. In fact, it's down in the south of Japan. It was almost like the Japanese wanted to keep them at arm's length, and with good reason, given that they kept getting drunk and smashing up places. You know, there's one story where William Adams takes them to visit the magnificent great copper Buddha at Kamakura. And the first thing they do is they etch their names into the copper, you know, scratching it. It's a fantastically English story. There they go, graffiti the thing, you know. So the Japanese wanted to keep them at arm's length and shove them onto this the island, a place called Hirado. And then the English eventually leave. They realize this is pointless and it's dangerous, and they leave. And this leaves this tiny little Dutch community who stay on for a few more years. But even they realize, you know, the writing's on the wall, and they eventually leave as well. And this is the point where really there are no more Europeans left in Japan. And Japan becomes a land of mystery for, you know, until the late 19th century, when the Americans, you know, sort of with their gunboat diplomacy, or not so diplomatic, in fact, they go along and they say, right, we're opening up this market for the goods we want to sell you. And that's the point where Japan opens up again. But what one interesting thing is the whole story of the hidden Christians, because as I say, the Jesuits had converted hundreds of thousands of people to Christianity. Now, many of these people gave it up as soon as the Jesuits left, but some of it kept it going. And when the Westerners kind of arrived back in Japan in the 19th century, they found these secret communities who had kept their faith going throughout this time. Extraordinary stories, you know.
Yes, it's so must be so odd to find. I wonder how it had evolved differently to other, you know, the sort of doctrine of Catholicism in Europe.
Yeah, I don't know about that, but one thing is sure, they had to keep it incredibly secret because, you know, if you were found out, you know, it was off with your head immediately, or that gentle, slow roasting, you know, that's what you could look forward to.
So yeah, and so I suppose from a Western angle, an American angle, you pick that up in the film The Last Samurai with Tom
Yes.
Cruise, who's in that. Yeah. Oh, this is fantastic. So Giles, Samurai William, when did you write that?
Oh my God, this is like I'm actually having to look now because I've, I was just opening the parcel arrived this afternoon with my new book in it, and I actually couldn't remember how many books I'd written, history books. I think it's 13. This was published in 2002. That shows how old I am.
Wonderful, wonderful. But it must have been lots of fun to write.
It was brilliant, but it was brilliant. I thoroughly enjoyed it because of all the letters and diaries. Because honestly, Ollie, you start reading these and you're plunged into another world, another universe. I mean, and the fact that they told life as it was, warts and all, and there were a lot of warts. It's just wonderful. It really you're able to really build a picture of their lives in this utterly alien country on the other side of the world.
And the clash of civilizations with Brits abroad and these refined, clean Japanese.
They were
Great
just
stuff.
horrified. They were horrified when these mariners, these sea dogs, pitched up at their shores in stinking Hessian rags.
Well, in the show, early on in the show, Blackthorn is the character in Shogun is offered, we've got the bath ready for you. He said, "Well, I washed last week." And the look the two Japanese servants give each other is hilarious. It's
Actually, the funny thing in mentioning that is Richard Cox, my man with the goldfish, the head of the English trading post. They also had this reaction. Well, why would we want a bath? We had one 3 months ago. But actually, when they started having baths, they thought, actually, this is great. We really like this. And then Richard Cox, alongside his vegetable patch, he built this huge, great bathhouse, and it ended up with the men having sort of several baths a day, which is probably explains why they didn't get much trade done. But they did enjoy quite a good lifestyle out there, and it should be said they lived very healthy lives apart from all the drinking and whoring and the sort of attendant sort of problems that brought. They ate a very good diet, fresh fish, fresh vegetables, and very few of them ever died to sickness, which if they'd been back in London they probably would have been dead years before.
Yes. Well, also another interesting thing to note, because I was talking to the historical consultant for the show, and he was saying that the dialogue in the show, and it's all the Japanese dialogue, is a form of medieval Japanese that would have been spoken in the period, which is interesting.
Yeah, I didn't realize that. Well, I know they've taken great lengths to be very authentic about the historical details, but I didn't know that. Yeah.
Yeah, and there's a lot of he's tried to have them include a lot of poetry as well, because the sort of warlords were all very interested in writing poetry all the time. Great stuff, Giles. Well, this is fantastic. Samurai William, links are in the show notes for listeners, and I do encourage you to get it. Thanks,
Thank you.
Giles.
Well, I encourage everyone to get it as well.
Thanks, Giles. All the
Thanks a
best.
lot. Cheers, Ollie. Thanks.
Thanks very much for listening. Please do share the episode. Plenty more great history to come, including Iran's relationship with Britain on Saturday. But in the meantime, thank you and good night.